This is Yetta Chaikin and Rona Finkelstein recording an oral history of Rabbi Leonard Gwirtz on December 29th, 1987 at Otis Kodesh Synagogue.
I wonder if you would give us some information for the Jewish Historical Society about the early years of your life. Begin with where you were born and something about your family.
I came from a very Orthodox family. My grandfather was very reluctant to emigrate to this country. But after going back and forth a few times, he decided he was going to emigrate. My father was bar mitzvah in this country. He got married in a very modern way. He courted my mother.
You mean instead of having an arranged marriage?
Arranged marriage. He was married in 1917, in the United States, but they were living in America, and he heard, well, someone told him, and he said, you call Leah Greenberg, and of course he went and called Leah Greenberg on the phone, and he talked to her, like to meet with her, and so forth. So what they do today, they went to a restaurant and so on, and then he went a second time, but my father told me that he knew the first time he looked at my mother, he wanted to marry her. and so he had married, and then, of course, he moved to Brooklyn. All the children were born in Brooklyn, and he was very prosperous there for a while. In fact, maybe even a millionaire, I don't know exactly, but I know that he used to bring every 2 years, another maid from Carolina to live with us in the house. We had a nice home, and he was in the jobbing business. He bought eggs. Mostly he visited Delaware, in fact. He was offered to come to Selbyville, Delaware, to organize a jobbing business, a co-op shipping business. This goes way back when he must have been only 22 years old. And then he would travel to Virginia and Carolina. And they knew he was an Orthodox Jew because when he visited all these farmers, he wouldn't eat with them. And he always wore the little kippah. And then he would say to them, can I just boil an egg? And they'd boil an egg. And then he would take out a spoon. He would crack the egg and he would eat the egg from the shell with his spoon. And then he washed his spoon, tucked it away in his pocket, and then he asked them if he could have a half a glass of milk or a glass of milk. And so, of course, he would boil the water in their pot. That wasn't too bad. And he would drink hot water with milk. So when he visited Goyim, well, the Goyim saw this, and they said to him, Mr. Gwirtz, you're not like all the other New York Jews. You're an Orthodox religious Bible Jew. And they trusted him, and then he built up a big business. Really, in fact, I didn't say he exploited his orthodoxy. And anyway, he was very prosperous. He had all these eggs coming in, and he sold at A&P, Bohack, all the big chains in those days. And he was a very prosperous fellow.
Did they call that butter and egg, or just egg?
No, well, he also was in the butter business. Uh-huh. His place was called the Butter and Egg, the Woods Butter and Egg Market.
Oh.
He was a wholesaler, like they call a wholesaler.
And can you tell us about his father in Europe?
Well, his father did approximately the same thing, but less, not in an organized fashion. He didn't have, let's say, his son's American know-how, so he didn't do it that way. But my father's father and my father's grandfather as I was told by my father, were in the same business in Europe. And they would get on a horse and wagon and go around amongst the Polish peasants and get eggs. They would pack it in what they called a shock air, and they would pack it, and then it wouldn't break, and then they would load it on the wagon. They would travel in the countryside. Of course, my grandfather and my father, as a little boy, went and spoke Polish fluently, and but they all knew he was a Jid. They all knew he was a Jid. And they then would pack it and ship it to Vienna. And that's the way my grandfather and my great-grandfather made a livelihood.
And your grandfather came to this country more than once. Do you want to tell
yes.
us about that?
Oh, yes. My grandfather, as I said before, was doubtful about the religious purity of this country. You know, some, of course, called it a golden Medina. I mean, it's a land flowing with gold, you know, on the streets. But, of course, it wasn't that way. The early immigrants had it very, very difficult. They were soaked by the slumlords and all that. But so my grandfather came here, and then he lived here for a while, did the business, went home, had a baby, stayed home with his wife, and left her, came back here. Well, he did this back and forth, and four children were born this way. My father's second oldest is Lena, and then my father, Henry, or Henoch, and then there is Yosef, and then there was another brother who died. I only knew never got married, and he died. I don't remember his name right now. So those were the four people born in Europe. And then, of course, Grandpa had here another seven children in this country.
Oh, my.
What part of Poland were you from?
Well, they came from Galicia.
It was called city?
Oh, yes. It's called Fristik. And they were Shendyshev. It's interesting that my wife's family comes from Shendyshev, and my family comes from Fristik. And they were only maybe 10 miles apart. And that's maybe the secret to my successful marriage. And and it wasn't that very far from Krakow, the very famous Polish city. The Pope today comes from Krakow, and Yiddish was called Kulki. But that's all to the southwest part of Poland. And there were many other towns. I know people in my congregation come, many of them, a lot of them come from there. Reiche is another community, not far from there. And I can't think of them all, but the countryside was studded with various little Jewish communities all around them. Unlike the Russian situation, there was no Pale settlement in Galicia. And those who know European Jewish history, the Austrian-Hungarian Empire was hospitable to Jews, and especially the Austrian part. You know, and he was called Kaiser Franz Josef. But Kaiser Franz Josef, the Jews called him Freim Yossel. Franz is Freim, Ephraim, and Yosef is Yossel. So they thought he was such a nice fellow that they called him this diminutive, endearing term, Kaiser Freim Yossel.
Would you want to tell us about your own early education?
Well, I went to a yeshiva. Today it's called a day school. I lived on a street where we had our shtiebel was on a street, which was always full with people. And then about a half a block down was the mikveh, where it obviously was frequented. By the way, men also went to mikveh. Right before my bar mitzvah, my father took me to mikveh because he wanted to dunk me, to purify me before I become a full Jew. And, of course, he made me go to mikveh. I would have gone myself anyway, but he suggested it very strongly before I got married. Mm. Not only did my wife go to mikveh before she was fully married, I also went to mikveh. So men went to mikveh. And on Erev Shabbos on Friday, you actually saw, I lived right there on the street. You know, you saw the men run to mikveh, and then when they came out, a hasten mikveh. See, a hasten mikveh was like it was like a schwitz. It was a machaya. A hasten mikveh. And the fellows would come out with red, rosy cheeks, red foreheads, and they were dripping with the mikveh water on their face, and they were making themselves straight. So men went to mikveh. So I saw this mikveh, And then down below, near Hopkinson Avenue, is where the yeshiva was. And the yeshiva had 1,000 children in those days. It was all 8 grades, first and all 8 grades of elementary school.
And so you went through that, and when you completed that, you went on?
Oh, I went on to Yaakov Yosef High School. There was in those days we had a very fine high school. My father wanted me to go to what is called, it still didn't exist, the Sifta Torah Benas. I told my father I was too chnyot, I mean, it's too black hat. And I didn't want that. I wanted to go to a more, it's a little more liberal, and where I can wear a little kippah and so on. So he said, all right. And I said, Daddy, look, over there they don't have a course in chemistry, they don't have a course in biology. In fact, oh, they did mathematics, of course, all right, but they don't have any laboratories. So I said, I want to study chemistry, biology. I want to prepare myself for college. He says, well, all right. So anyway, he gave in to me, and I went to the Yeshivat Rabbeinu Yaakov Yosef. Well, this was at the height of the Depression, 1933-34, and unfortunately, they couldn't maintain the budget. So all of us were automatically switched to Yeshiva College. I went to the high school of Yeshiva College, and that's where I graduated. Mm. So with now that, I also had to travel every day, 1 hour and 15 minutes on the subway. I would get up in the morning about 6:30. I was on the subway at 7:30, arrived about 8:45, classes started at 9:00, and then of course we stayed there until 7, 8 in the evening, 7 in the evening, and then I would come home on the subway, and I would get home 9:30, but then I would do all my homework on the subway.
No time for basketball.
No. Well, we played basketball. I played a lot of basketball. In fact, that's one of the big reasons why I switched from the yeshiva. In my 12th year, I lost a little interest, a little enthusiasm in studying Talmud. So I used to play basketball. They had a nice basketball there, a nice court, and so on. I was playing a lot of basketball. I used to play before, too. Yeshiva University High School expected us to do some calisthenics. We had to do some push-ups. And we had about 2 periods a week where for about, 60 minutes or 50 minutes where we did many things together. We used to play with pins and some other little things to coordinate ourselves. But only Yeshiva College had the facilities in there. We had some basketball and no swimming pool. So we didn't do that. I still can't swim well for that reason.
What was your reason for going to City College?
Well, then I transferred because I mentioned now that I became more interested in basketball than in studying Talmud.
Yeah.
So my father and I never really had a battle over things. He was a reasonable fellow, and I was a reasonable fellow. So we used to argue with each other, and I would listen to him. And most important of all, mother always would listen outside. And then after he left, she would sit me down, and she argued his case the way a mother knows how to argue the case. And she always convinced me that Daddy was right. So, of course, I switched from Yeshiva College High School and went to a more pious school. I also knew about the rabbi because I had 2 friends who I had contact with in socialistic club activity, and they were studying there, and they told me I would like it. It's a very free atmosphere. The Rebbe is a nephew of the famous Chafetz Chaim, a Rebbe, one of the great, great saints of Europe in the 20s and 30s, and his nephew was running this yeshiva that I would really enjoy. I would like the ambience there, the intellectual atmosphere. It would be worthwhile.
Did you enjoy it?
Yes. And so I left there, and I was studying. Well, then I didn't have yeshiva college, so I had to go to college, and I decided. I didn't care to go to Brooklyn College for certain reasons, so I decided to go to CCNY, and my Rebbe was very understanding. He realized that, that I have to do this. I have what is called a Meshgiach. The Meshgiach is a supervisor of the men on the floor during the day when the Rebbe is not there. See, the Rebbe is preparing and studying whatever he's doing. And then when you come in to listen to the Shir on Monday and Thursday, with Meshgiach, you know the word Meshgiach, Kashrut, he is a supervisor. So he would, I noticed he would look at my books, and he was peeping there what kind of books I read. And this guy was an overly ambitious dictator or supervisor, and he made me uncomfortable. And I told him, I said to him, Rabbi Scheinberg, if you want to know what I'm reading, come over to me. I'll show you what I'm reading. You don't have to go there in my desk, behind my back and see
You were suspect.
A little. But, well, anyway, that's the big reason why I left this school and went to the Hebrew Theological College in Chicago. And that's where this was even more liberal, and this was much more to my spirit at this time, at the age of 21, and I was happier there.
And you were ordained?
At the Hebrew Theological College.
In Chicago?
In Chicago. Uh-huh. There I got my, you notice I have a smicha, a diploma, you notice, on one side, and the other side is given to me by Professor Meyer Waxman. He conducted the, what it's called, the Chachmat Yisrael Department, the Department of Haskalah, of Haskalah Literature. So I studied with him, in fact, I excelled with him, and I studied philosophy, medieval Jewish philosophy, contemporary philosophy, and then Bible and other things. And anyway, so when I graduated, not everybody got this. The boys, in order to get smicha, you know, in order to graduate, had to get the real smicha. This is the classic smicha. But I also did that because I liked this liberal Haskalah atmosphere. I studied that with him too.
I want to go back for one moment. I want you to describe Brownsville, the area in which you grew up.
Well, Brownsville is in the 20s and 30s was a center of Jewish life. The Jews came there as a so-called second residence. They left the Lower East Side of Manhattan, and some went to the Bronx. But the Bronx, you had large apartment houses, which were cheaper. Brownsville had one section of private houses, we called them. I mean, one family residences. That is what we called a private house. And then the other side of Pitkin Avenue, everyone heard of Pitkin Avenue. The other side of Pitkin Avenue had a tall apartment house, but these were new. So I suppose they belonged to banks, and it wasn't yet, they weren't considered slums. In the 50s and the 60s, they were considered slums. And when the blacks lived there in the 60s and 70s, they destroyed them and it's all burnt down. Burn, baby, burn. But way back in the 20s and 30s, these were nice apartment houses. And those who were with lower income or those who worked in factories lived there. The middle class people lived in these one family houses. So, but all these Jews spoke Yiddish. Those who were born, who immigrated from Europe all spoke Yiddish. There were three theaters where Menashe Shkolnik and Boris Tomaszewski and some of the other greats that I've seen. I had a friend, by the way, who was a nephew to Menashe Shkolnik. So he always used to get me in on Saturday nights through the back door. And I was watching these things. Anyway.
Well, but as long as you're talking about the theater, tell us, we'll get back to Brownsville. Tell us a little about the Yiddish theater in this era.
Well, the Yiddish theater, I only know it, by the way, only as a young teenage person. I visited, I enjoyed it, I knew Yiddish well. My first language that I spoke was Yiddish.
And is that the language you spoke in your home?
Yes, mother and father,
yeah.
When I was born, only spoke Yiddish.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, mother and father could speak English, too. It's like my son today and his wife are speaking English at home in Yerushalayim because they want their little son to learn
English. Huh.
And he'll pick up Hebrew, there's no problem. So,
yeah.
And then he'll go to school, they have no word. They want him to know English. So my mother and father spoke only Yiddish, and that was my first language. In fact, all of us, except my youngest brother. See, by the way, when I already was like 11, and then obviously I only spoke English.
Yeah.
And then my younger brother did, so, and my sister was being influenced by us too, and so when my youngest brother came along, it was gone, and the house was an English-speaking house. But when mother and father dominated, and I was growing up, it was a Yiddish-speaking house. So I was very easy to learn that, and I enjoyed speaking it. And, now the theater. Now, there were, in those days, in the 20s and the 30s, at least, let me see, three Yiddish theaters in Brooklyn, at least three in the Lower East Side, and at least two or three in the Bronx. So you have eight theaters, and all supporting themselves and well-attended. And, of course, on Friday night and Saturday night, it was packed. So now the people went there Friday night, of course, weren't religious. Maybe some of the religious people went Saturday night. But, my father didn't care for theater. He didn't care for movies. He called it the greatest shtick. He wouldn't have it. Now, my father read the New York Times. He read the New York Herald Tribune. He read all the markets, especially the commodity market. That's where he made his money and lost his pants. In 1928, he lost his money before the stock market broke on the commodity market. So he read all these things, and he was alert and so on. But yet, he had very strong opinions, very orthodox opinions about the Yiddish theater. Mother would like to have gone, but father didn't go. You know. I went only because I had a free pass. Uh-huh. So I saw these things, Menashe Skolnik and all the others, in the Hopkinson Avenue Theater. There was the Parkway Theater on Eastern Park. It was a nice, big, beautiful parkway. And there was beautiful homes there. And, of course, that was a little for the richer Jews who went to the Parkway Theater. That's about all I can say.
Okay, Brownsville. Let's get back to the ideological aspects of it.
Well, Brownsville was made up of socialists and religious Jews Republicans, at least according to my father. My father was a Republican, and my grandfather was a Republican. This is unusual. As soon as they came here, my father grew up. He was very friendly with a Mr. Friedlander, who was a state assemblyman, a Republican, and so some reason or other, Dad thought that's the way to be. Of course, at the time when he had money, he voted for Hoover against Roosevelt. But later he voted for Roosevelt. Later on, he began to vote for Roosevelt. But most of the Jews, those who were in the working classes, as we'd say, voted for the Socialist Party. The Socialist Party was strong in Brownsville. It had Charlie Solomon was the representative to the House of Representatives, the only socialist person. There was a Mayor McLevy up in Milwaukee, but no Wisconsin had a lot of socialists, German socialists, but they never sent anybody to Congress. Only the Jews sent someone to Congress. Connecticut also had some socialist Jews, and they also had, but nobody went there. There was a very important person called Karl Zladek. Vladek, in fact, there are houses in the Lower East Side right off the Williamsburg Bridge called the Vladek houses. Vladek was, at one point in this period in the 30s, he was president of the New York City Council. But then he was not on the Socialist Party. The Socialist Party went down, and then they formed at that time the American Democratic Labor Party. And that party was made up of unions by Sidney Hillman, Dubinsky. Dubinsky was the head of the garments, and Hillman was I don't remember now. Anyway, the passage was Sidney, Roosevelt said, in 1936, that was Sidney Hillman. Well, the unions were very strong in the New York area, and they dominated the city council politics.
Yes. There was a lot of Marxism early in the 30s.
There were. Oh, well, the Daily Worker had a big, pretty big circulation.
Right.
The Socialist Call. And then, of course, I'm giving you the two English papers. But in Yiddish, you had, the Morgenjournal was Republican. Der Tag was Democratic. The Vorwärts was Socialist. The Arbeiter. The Communist was called. I don't remember right now the Communist Yiddish paper, but also had it must have had at the height about 50,000 readers.
Oh wow!
See, the Forwards at this time at the height had 300,000-400,000 readers.
And you were is there any conflict for you in terms of these various ideologies?
I was very familiar with all of them, and as a yeshiva boy. I had no trouble in being a member of the Young People's Socialist League at the City College of New York, where we have an active chapter, and we brought down lecturers at CCNY. I was on the council of the students there at CCNY. I took an active interest in the young people. We were called the YPSLs, YPSL, Young People's YPSLs. And the YPSLs was pretty active at CCNY. I remember one time getting beat on the head by a communist, the Daily Worker. The Daily Worker is the name of a communist. I was distributing a student paper called The Socialist Call. And as I was distributing The Socialist Call on campus, someone clobbered me from the back. I don't know what it was, but it must have been one of those. He took all my papers away, threw them down in the sewer, and then he began to distribute his Daily Worker. But of course, we overcame that. Next 2 days, when if I would distribute, there were two friends of mine who acted to my protectors, and they wouldn't do that. Maybe they would have had a big fight today. They let it pass.
When did you meet Gladys? And how?
I can't go into that. I met her when I already was a rabbi. I was a bachelor rabbi in Atis Kodesh. I suppose I decided it's about time that I should get married, and I used my good offices and other offices to go about and to find myself the most appropriate wife who would be wonderful for me.
All right. So you had several, you went various places before you came to Atis Kodesh.
I was a rabbi a very fine congregation which I built up. It was originally a conservative congregation, Or Chadash, in Englewood, Chicago. Englewood is the southwest section of Chicago, and I was a rabbi there in 46. I came in 47. 44, 45, and 46. And I was single, so I had a lot of time, and I didn't waste it, so I was going to to the University of Chicago at the same time. I got my master's, and I was encouraged by Dr. Louis Wirth, so one of the leading sociologists of the time, and others, to, then I went to, an unusual thing for an Orthodox rabbi to do, I went to the Divinity School of the University of Chicago, and I studied with Professor Eric Loomer. He was an important Baptist thinker, and others. I took a lot of courses with him, and then I went to James Luther Adams, the leading Unitarian thinker in the 40s, and I studied with him, and I got my master's, and he wanted me to get my PhD further, but it's Nishkin Bashar. See, in other words, what was more important, to get married, Abend Zwei Kinderlach, or to get a PhD with James Luther Adams? He always wrote, and he said, Leonard, you made a mistake.
But did this kind of education have an influence your life, your direction that you took?
Well, in all probability, my openness, it wasn't really this influenced this. It's, in mitzvah go right at mitzvah, one mitzvah leads to another mitzvah. So obviously, there were many things that I had been doing when I was 14, 15, which led me to do them when I was 17, 18, which led me to do that when I was 21, 22, I going to college at CCNY, and led me to leave that yeshiva and go to the other yeshiva.
So in other words, from an early age.
So my openness, I'm convinced now, it wasn't just, why did I go to Divinity School and associate with all the goyim there, and I felt very comfortable with them, and they felt very much at ease with me. So, and then James Luther Adams, he's published so many books on Christian ethics and so on. No, I never felt uncomfortable.
Uh-huh.
And they, obviously, apparently it's reciprocal. So if I mingle freely with them, they mingle freely with me. And I never had any problems with them. And by the way, I never saw any, at least at this level, any desire to convert me. See, I've met local schmoes who are Gallup here has no brains, and he thinks he's going to try to convince me to accept Christianity. Well, he has no brains. But over there, that didn't exist. In other words,
you were above that.
On the graduate level with these people, in fact, there was a Professor Henry Nelson Wieman. He didn't even believe in God. And you have to know, you're familiar with Whitehead and Whiteheadian thought. So where I was going, where Whiteheadian thought is the thing. And Loomer taught Whiteheadian thought, and Henry Nelson Wieman, he's a philosopher. So, and I also mingle with him. He, in other words, he'd say to me, Leonard, he says, I think that your conception of God as a rabbi is far better than what we Christians have to offer.
Maybe you converted him.
So in other words, there was no ever any attempt.
Uh-huh.
It was a very, and University of Chicago, at least in that place, and I'm pretty sure at Harvard and at Yale, where you have divinity schools, I'm pretty sure
same
the same
level,
must
right.
be the same level.
When you left Chicago, where did you go?
Well, I came here. See, before, I was a rabbi in Chicago 3 years. I left to come here. And even before I was in Chicago, while I was being ordained and preparing, I used to have a weekend position in Danville, Illinois. Now, this may be true. See, I went to Danville, I suppose, because I wanted to earn some money. And secondly, I wanted to get some experience. I knew that I was going to become a rabbi at a certain point. And I decided, well, I need to meet people, to mingle with people. I want to see all these yokels, you know, in Danville, Illinois. So I went there, and I thought maybe they were yokels, but I was very tolerant of them. They were very tolerant of me. And so I was there for 3 years. See, I would come out there weekends, and then a Shabbos, Sunday morning. I organized a school, not a big conservative synagogue. I laid the foundations of that period. And I had a school Sunday morning with 100 children. And I had mothers volunteering and so on. So I realized then that I have a certain ability to handle these matters, and I can function practically in the rabbinate. I realized that. I saw I can do this. So then I gave that up, and I purposely stayed in the university in Chicago because I told my placement committee I want to study to get a PhD at the University of Chicago. That was my intention. And I was doing that all in all. But I suppose I decided I had to get married, and that maybe was more important.
So you came to Atascosa?
Yes, then, so I was in Danville, Illinois, Englewood, South Chicago, with the, I think, which was very important, with the ancillary work I did at the University of Chicago, and then I came here. And by the way, here, after 2-3 years, I went to drop seat, on my own.
So you continued studying?
Oh, I studied. I was at drop seat, completed all my residence at drop seat, and I began writing my thesis with Professor Ephras, who was a great scholar, a poet and a Hebrew scholar, and with him, let me tell you a little anecdote. I always remember this. When I came into Professor Ephras' office in the room, and then drop seat only had 5-6 students to a class. So I walked in with a yarmulke, right? And everybody was sitting without a yarmulke. But Professor Ephras was also without a yarmulke. So, he knew what I thought of him. So he didn't say anything to me. And I recited, and it's something that we were studying Sadia. So I was reciting Sadia. This was all spot reading. We were doing this, and it looks very nice. And then when I came to the word Adonai Hashem, I look up at him, you know, and I say the word, I'm wearing the yarmulke, and I say God's name. And he, I look up at him, and I look at him. And he's sitting there without the yarmulke. Now there was another fellow, Professor Zeitlin, I think he read his books. Zeitlin was a great Talmudist. Zeitlin also was without a yarmulke, but occasionally, I don't know why, he would take out his little yarmulke, whatever he knew the subject matter he's going to cover, in the Talmud he would wear the yarmulke. Then he'd take off the yarmulke and he studied the rest of the Talmud. Well, I don't know how he did these things. I still don't know why he did, but at least I saw he somehow makes a distinction here and he's trying his best. But Ephras did. So one time I was reciting, and I said something, and I said an idea, and I attributed it to Sadi. He says, Yerilts. He says, that's not Sadi. He says, that's your Christian education. He says, that's your Christian education. He knew I went to divinity school in Chicago. He says, that's your Christian, your Christian theology, and you're reading it into Sadi. So I said, well, it's possible. And so he didn't stop. He says, I want to tell you. He says, you are more Christian with the yarmulke, and I am more Jewish without the yarmulke. Professor Ephras told me. I didn't say anything. I never took off my yarmulke, see? But he explained himself. Now, this took about a half a year until he put me in my place, and he told me. Oh, we were very close friends after that. He didn't, but that's what he said to me. That's a, that's extremely important to remember. And but of course he was dean. He founded the Baltimore Hebrew Teachers College. That was his school. Ephraim is a very important person. And then he founded the Hebrew department at Hunter. He taught at Hunter, that all girls come. Now it's whatever. Anyway, he taught Hunter, and then he wrote many books, and then he was considered the leading Hebrew poet in the United States of America. If you look up the Hebrew poets in this country, I think Zilber Schlag, that fellow, wrote a two-volume work on that, and I purposely brought it. He considers Ephrus the leading Hebrew poet in the United States. Anyway, so that was my I was put in my place.
Yeah. I want to go back to Adas Kodesh. They hired you.
Yeah.
And for the record, in terms of memories of earlier Wilmington, can you tell us something about the hiring procedure when you came? Who were some of the people that you remember? And just a little, a few of the incidents.
Well, I tell you, first, be honest, when I came here, I didn't think I was going to stay very long, because the synagogue and some of the membership, and hope this is not going to be read until after I'm gone, that some of the membership really were not for me to be attracted to this congregation. Having heard my intellectual background, my academic background, and so on, this was not the congregation that I thought I would stay with. I came here because I wanted to come east, and I thought this would be a stepping stone
to
something
else,
to New York, something like that. Well, anyway, there's a whole story. How did I come here? See,
yeah.
It wasn't. See, they had here Rabbi Singer, Rabbi Joseph Singer, who was my predecessor and a very nice man. He came here from Chevrat Tilim in New Orleans, Louisiana. And so Rabbi Singer was here. He was married to Chaim Heller's daughter. Chaim Heller is one of the great, great minds in Bible studies in Orthodox circles. He was famous at Hebrew University, Chaim Heller and so on. So Chaim Heller met his daughter, married his daughter. Joe Singer married Chaim Heller's daughter. Well, he came, he was happy also. His father-in-law, you know, Joe Singer's family lives in Los Angeles. But Chaim Heller's daughter lived in New York, so she wanted to be closer to her father. Anyway, he came here, like I said, maybe it's the same reason that I came here. And he was here, and he managed to get along nicely. Now, I'm not going to go with some of the dirty things which he may have done to me, is not important. When the opportunity presented itself for him to leave, he grabbed it. Now, the opportunity presented itself August 1, 1947. He heard about this position, which was in Brooklyn, Manhattan Beach, Brooklyn. It was a nice congregation in those days. Manhattan Beach was very prosperous and so on. So he went there, and maybe it's over here, it's happened before. And he went there, and he wanted, so when he heard this was open, Dr. Belkin, the president of Yeshiva University, who had great respect for Dr. Chaim Heller, did everything to enable Rabbi Joseph Singer to get into Manhattan Beach, Brooklyn. Well, he left. So now when he left, nobody knew. See, there were certain rumbles, and he was unhappy. They insulted his wife. It was a very, maybe it was their fault, I don't know. But anyway, so he left. And one day, someone walks by on Van Buren there, in 7th and 8th there, I walk up those steps. I think he lived in one of the Kyle houses, which one of the Kyle family people owned, and they see it's empty. They walk upstairs and go, Hayala Renan, he's not here. What do you mean he left without telling us? No one. So he just was very angry, and he left. Well, now they realize they don't have a rabbi. So Mr. Ezzy Greenblatt, if you know him, was president of the shul. So what can he do? He didn't know about placement committee or what have you, where Yeshiva University. So he went to Rabbi Joseph Waldman. Rabbi Joseph Waldman, you know, at that time was a millionaire butcher. Of course, he supplied black market meat in the war years, kosher meat, the whole East Coast.
Yeah.
And he was very prosperous, and he had the
Miami
Beach
and Miami Beach. Mm-hmm.
So he went to him, and Mr. Greenblatt said, well, Rabbi Waldman knows everything. Rabbi Waldman is a millionaire six times over. So I'll go to him. He's a smart man. So Waldman said, all right. Okay. So Waldman, I'm not going to how that happened. He knew my uncle in Waterbury, Connecticut. Well, my uncle said, no, I'm not interested in coming in. But he says, look, I have a nephew very capable, and I'm sure that he's most adequate for your congregation. Yeah, it's okay. Let him come down. So Waldman called me, or Greenbach called me, and I came here somewhere to August the 15th, and I spoke. They wanted to give me the contract right there and then. I can daven, I can sing, I read half of the Torah, and I spoke, and they wanted to give me the contract. So Saturday night, I sat down with the committee. Mr. Chester was in the committee, Jimmy Chester, and a few others were in the committee. And I said, look, gentlemen, I cannot pull a singer on my congregation. My congregation thinks they gave me a 7-week vacation. You know, I'm coming here with my family, my parents, I'm on the beach, but I can't say I'm going to come to you starting, let's say, September 1. What about my congregation or Chadash in Chicago? I have to go back to them. Well, they say, if you're going to go back, you won't have to visit. So Nishpasher is Nishpasher. So, okay. Anyway, I'm not going to the politics. I know there was some politics here. That someone from the seminary, they thought they were going to get him. Others said no, because there was a strong Orthodox faction. Well, they, some guy said, hey, this fighting around took time. So they say it's already November, October, November. Why not call Rabbi Gewirtz? You know, he was here. We all liked him. Let's find out. Jules Chester flew to Chicago. He knew Chicago from other experiences. Doing Warriors, maybe. He had Hershey chocolate. He had a monopoly, which he made money on. Anyway, so he knew Chicago. He came. He stayed at the Hilton Hotel or something. And he called me up and he says, can you come downtown to see me, blah, blah, blah. Oh, yes, okay. So on a Sunday afternoon, I came there. He says, look, the people haven't forgotten you. They want you to come back and be their rabbi. I said, all right, you'll give me 2 weeks. Because it's all right, now everything is over. I told my people that this may happen. And you'll give me 2 weeks. I'll have to get another principal for the school. The rabbi, they'll get someone else in the meantime. You know, you're sure, you know, you have auditioning, they'll get 6 rabbis every week. No, no. But the school, I said, was very important to me. We'll get the school firmly, you know, established and everything. Okay. So we did that, and I came here. And, of course, I flew in, and I spoke, and the place was full. And they said, yes, they want that one. So that's when, 1947, I became the rabbi. And then, of course, I wired back my people, and I went back there, you know, after that thing was straightened out here, I went back and bought my books and things and so forth. So I became the rabbi.
And so...
Now, when I came here, I already told you how I felt. And so, then we got married and, you know, and then the most important thing happened. See, Izzy Tanzer, Izzy Silverman to some extent also, and then a few other people, see, Ralph Thomases, and we had a Sunday morning Bible study group, and Norman Schiffsman, and in other words, there were a bunch of people who came. Dr. Klein from Beth Emeth came over. No, I began to get some following in different congregations and our own, who wanted to hear what Rabbi Gewirtz has to say and how he thinks and so on. So I had a Sunday morning, used to have 20 people, 25 people. So I said, well, this is not bad, and maybe we can do something here. Well, little by little, the congregation grew, and after 5 years, they were already speaking of a new synagogue. And
So the congregation was not exactly what you wanted in the beginning.
No.
But so you had some frustrations. Is that?
There were. Yeah. See, I think a rabbi always has frustrations. I don't think any rabbi has it ever easy. Because, sometimes, unfortunately, they have pure personality conflicts. You know, I have a bar mitzvah. I think, what can happen to a bar mitzvah? I mean, the boys get called up, and, you know, and then you tell the sister to cater or what have you. And, you know, I'm supposed to be, in fact, basically, that's not the rabbi's primary activity or secondary activity. But, in other words, so he is the facilitator, right? He facilitates this and facilitates that. Okay. Then something happens, I don't know, a glass breaks or the bottle turns over. That's something ridiculous. Whoo, boy, the rabbi, he mishandled this whole thing. And Roger, Roger, Roger. And then someone who's friendly to this, some comes to the board meeting, and they make a mountain out of a molehill. And to me, it was ridiculous. The whole thing was ridiculous. And then my president talks to me. All right, I don't have to come there to defend myself. But then he starts talking to me, and it's like gives me a lecture on how to deal with people. I mean, I'm not going to say to me, Shmo, I've been doing this for so many years, and it happens to be that I built a synagogue, and it happens to be that I have a lot of friends, and it happens to be that I do know how to talk to people. But if you think this and this and this, I said, leave it alone. I'm fully aware it won't happen again. So this is very, very frustrating. Always, this can happen twice a year. This can happen twice a year. And this is very, very, it's very disappointing. Because you would expect, see, this I would think why maybe more intellectually capable rabbis don't care to become rabbis, which is, by the way, the case. See, I don't know how it is in the Reform or the Conservative movement, although I'm pretty sure it doesn't go exactly how I'm going to define it. See, right now, in the Orthodox circles, only 10% of the rabbis are top intellectual caliber. In other words, those who are very able, and they are, they're the writers, they're the thinkers, and so on. Let's see, from Yeshiva University in Northern Chicago, the capable people are becoming lawyers. They got smicha. But they're becoming lawyers.
Because of this problem.
Because
that
of this,
about.
This foolish problem. They hear, see, they tell each other.
Yeah.
And in other words, let's say a 24-year-old capable person who is an A student, you know, a magna cum laude at the University of Chicago, and he bumps into his friend who is, let's see, 38 or 40, and he says, ba, ba, ba. So the guy says, he said, don't come. It's not true. They won't appreciate you, and the whole thing is a mess.
Yeah, so these are the major kinds of frustrations that you have as a rabbi.
Yes.
Yes.
I think it's ridiculous.
Yeah.
In other words, for instance, I'll give you an example. We had a tough problem with women. You know, women, should women have aliyahs? So I call up New York and I find out what they're doing. I call up my niece, who's very active in the women's lib movement amongst Orthodox.